All right. Which one do you think these men started out as with the Church of England, but later became a Baptist? Which one? That is correct.
Yeah.
William Carey. Okay, which of these men started out very wealthy but was so poor at the end of his life, he and his wife had to live with one of their sons?
I had never told you this.
It's Wilberforce, yeah.
Yeah, I think I read that somewhere, but I don't remember.
Yeah, so he was born into a really wealthy family and accumulated more wealth as he inherited more. And then when he became a Christian, he began to be troubled by all the things that he had and the needs of people, needs of the poor. So he sold some of his property, and then over time he gave lots and lots of money away, and to the point where he had a son that he tried to get started in the dairy business. And anytime you get into the cattle business,
you never know.
So yeah, so he ended up losing everything at the end. But he'd given away a lot. So, and he even said at the end, he said it was a blessing from God because he got to know his sons better, and just to be with them towards the end of his life. Okay, which of these men? His great-grandfather trusted Christ just hours before he got married.
Hudson Taylor?
That's Taylor, yep. That's Hudson Taylor's there. Great-grandfather. Which of these men was a cobbler or a shoemaker for several years?
William Carey?
That's William Carey. Which of these men became a champion for taking the gospel to the interior of China? That's Hudson Taylor.
Hudson Taylor. Oh, Hudson
Taylor.
Okay. He went to China.
Yep. Which of these men was successful in making sure the British East India Company allowed missionaries to minister in England or in India? No, he didn't. He went to India, but it was actually Wilberforce. So the British East India Company had this charter or a monopoly given to them by the government to just do as they wanted, basically, in India. And one of the things, they didn't allow missionaries in because they didn't want the Indian people to really be changed. And Wilberforce was pretty unhappy about the gospel not being able to be preached there. And he heard of a lot of practices that he thought that the gospel could certainly make lives better for people there. And one of them, and you may know this, but in Hinduism, when the husband dies, the wife is expected to throw herself on top of the burning funeral pyre. And if she doesn't, then everybody helps her on there. So Wilberforce he just thought, the gospel, these people need to know what life is really supposed to be about. And so he worked very hard to change that, to get that so that they would allow missionaries in. William Carey actually went without being allowed in. Number 7. Which of these men fought for the elimination of the slave trade and emancipation of slaves?
Abraham Lincoln.
That's Wilberforce again.
Oh, okay.
So, I just finished a biography of him, so I decided I needed to tell just a little bit more about it. So not only did he fight to end it in for Britain, which he eventually got. He also worked internationally. He worked with the worked to make sure the French did and other countries as well. And mostly it was the French were the ones that were giving him the trouble. So when the during the French Revolution, they talked about everybody being free and equal and so on, but they held on to slavery in especially in the Caribbean. When Napoleon came around, he decided to eliminate slavery, but then when they defeated Napoleon, the king brought, oh no, we're not going to eliminate slavery. And you would think that since it took all these powers to defeat Napoleon, that France wouldn't have any say at the bargaining table at the peace talks and so on. But actually, they had a lot of power. And early on, Wilberforce wasn't able to win out, but later on he did. And so all the slave trade was ended as far as Europeans doing it.
So, Lonnie, do we know of any support that William Wilberforce had for American abolition?
He didn't work very much at that, but people took heart with that, and a lot of people took inspiration from things. One of the things that they did was, because freed slaves often didn't have much for a living to do, the Wilberforce and several others set up the colony of Sierra Leone, so that there would be, and to prove to people, hey, blacks can do well. That if they don't need to have whites take care of them. So America did the same thing. We set up Liberia. So it's mixed results, though. But the intention, if you read about it in American history books today, it'd be like, oh, everybody in Britain and America were prejudiced, even though they wanted to get rid of abolition or get rid of slavery. But it was way more well-intentioned than that.
Oh, yeah.
So, which of these men started the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals?
Yes,
Wilberforce. He did, yeah. And there are like 20 different things, because he looked at England and said, we've got lots and lots of social ills, and we need to change these things. When Wilberforce went into the Parliament, there were like three men total that were strong Christians. And when he finished in Parliament, there were like 100. So it was like a good boys club to get into and make things better for yourself, richer for yourself. And Wilberforce's work turned that around to where people look and said, I want to serve in Parliament to help England become a better place. So not everybody, but it changed the outlook for the most part. Which of these men tried to toughen himself up in preparation for the hardships of being a missionary by sleeping on boards and working in the cold?
Hudson Taylor?
Yeah, that was Hudson Taylor. Yeah. So as a teenager, he believed he was called to the mission field, and he thought, I'm way too pampered to make it, so I'm going to do things that make myself tougher. Which of these men decided that the missionary should dress like the people they're trying to reach? No. Hudson Taylor. Which of these men was inspired for missions after reading a biography of a missionary to Native Americans?
Carey.
Yeah, William Carey. And which of these men taught themselves several languages?
Wilberforce.
Yes, yes. All three of them did. All three of them. Yeah. Now, Wilberforce had a really strong college education, but he pretty much was a party boy all the way through. And so when he got saved, he felt like, I need to really do what I missed out on. And one of those things he taught himself several languages. And William Carey taught himself Greek and Hebrew while he was a shoemaker. And Hudson Taylor taught himself Chinese and other languages while he was still a teenager. So I don't know how they did it. I wasn't very good at learning language. Yeah.
We have tapes and everything.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those are tonal.
Yeah. Especially the Chinese would have been really difficult because Chinese is really tonal. And
well, it's not phonetic either.
Right. Right. And so when he was teaching himself, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. They'd gotten a copy of the book of Luke that had been translated, but it was in pictographs. And he and his roommate, they took an English version of Luke and then just figured out what those would be. It took them a long, long time to figure it out. But
so how did you get the sounds?
They didn't get the sounds. They just knew what the pictograph would say. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Thank you. Here we go.
So that's the whole thing. We're going to start on what would be the third page. First years in China. And we've talked about some of the sicknesses that they came across and when we were looking earlier, and we talked about consumption. Kathy, what did we decide it was?
Tuberculosis.
That's right. So, and there were other diseases that were similar at times that they referred to as consumption. And if tuberculosis just makes you wither away to nothing, so that's why it's called consumption. And I asked Madison what she thought the malignant fever was, and she thought it was sepsis. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. First year's in China. So he gets there, and he the money that's supposed to be there from his missions organization was not there. So he kept borrowing against it. Eventually it did come, but it only was enough to pay back what people had loaned him to live on. So, and it was also a time of the Taiping Rebellion, so it was not safe to go outside the walls of the compound area. He did at times do that, but I had to dodge bullets and cannon fire and so on. So he worked for a year at Shanghai at a medical clinic, and it became clear, though, to him also that the girl that he thought he would marry and that they'd be missionaries in China forever, Marianne, that she wasn't going to come to China to be his wife. So that was really, really difficult for him. But after a year, he and another missionary traveled to the village of Tung Chau. And when they were taken there on river boats, and the guys who took them said, "We will wait here for you for so long, but we think you're going to be killed, so we won't wait too awfully long. By the end of the day, if you're not back, we'll assume that you're dead, and we'll just go back." So they went into the city and began to hand out tracts and to tell about Jesus, and Hudson Taylor got grabbed by the neck and lifted up, and his buddy got roughed up, and eventually they asked to see the local magistrate, and they got to see the magistrate, and the magistrate, they told him what they were there for, and he said, "Okay, that sounds good to me," and he gave them protection then, and people totally changed their mind about how bad these people were when they had the protection, and they were able to share the gospel then. And the guys at the boats were really surprised to see them. when they came back that night. He made several trips inland then and moved to the city of Ningpo to help Dr. Parker, who was also with the same missionary group that he was, set up a hospital. And Hudson began to think about how people in the inland were afraid of him because of his blonde, curly hair and the way he dressed like an Englishman. And most of the people, they get on the coast, people had seen foreigners before, but when you move to an inland city, people had never seen somebody from other than somebody from China. So he was encouraged by Dr. Medhurst to take on the look of the Chinese. So he shaved the top of his head and got a fake pigtail and got clothing like Chinese. And he had to learn how to walk because the pants were really long and the shoes were such that you would trip easily. So it wasn't just putting on the clothes. You had to learn how to move well within them as well. But he had decided that that was the right thing to look like the Chinese. So anybody think that he made a mistake? Was that the wrong thing to do?
Oh, yeah. A bunch of people would probably say that he's appropriating their culture.
Okay, yep. I know what my dad would say because one time we were missionaries at church and they showed that the wife had gotten a nose ring because all the women in that culture had a nose ring if they were married. And my dad, oh, that's just horrible to dress like the heathens and be like the heathens. So, and a lot of the English thought, the same way, other than the one guy who had encouraged them. No, you don't. You stay like an Englishman. That's what Christians look like. So, were you going to say something?
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean, even Jesus wore a robe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way Christians should dress if we're going to make a strong stand on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I had a little talk with my dad, but not. I don't think I changed his mind on it, but go ahead.
I don't know how he could walk with those long pants.
Yeah, it was.
He would rip them.
Yeah, it was very difficult. It was very difficult. So.
Best if you wear a denim skirt. That's the most spiritual.
Well, he learned.
I would think the people there would think that he's trying to identify with them.
Yeah.
And learn their way.
Yeah, and he not only shaved the front part of his head, he blackened his hair so that he just wouldn't be strange looking to them. Yep.
So if you adopt the clothing and the food, and as long as you're not participating in some kind of religious or, you know, spiritual activity that, you know, I'm thinking back in the New Testament where, you know, eating meat, sacrifice to idols. I mean, I can see where that was a controversy, because maybe you are actually participating in the worship of those idols or something.
At the same time, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, same book, I've become all things to all people.
Exactly.
So that by all possible means I might win some.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think along with what Kathy said, I mean, there is a big talk. People get ridiculed for appropriating culture. You know, everybody's offended, or not, people are offended by that. But there's this guy that goes around on YouTube and he actually dresses up like in Mexican clothing or in African clothing or Chinese even. And he goes to he'll go to Chinatown and he'll say, "Are you offended by what I'm wearing?" They're like, no, you look very nice.
Yeah.
You know? So I think Kathy's right. I think they're honored when you make an effort.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
Because you have to learn the language.
Yeah. Yes. Letter I. He learned that the city of Swato had that the need of the gospel in that city, and he and another missionary friend decided that they would go there to the city and set up a clinic and preach there. And so for Hudson, everywhere he's going, he's setting up medical clinic too, because that's their introduction to people, and not only meeting needs but to be able to get a chance just to talk to people to begin with. So they're there for a while. Things are going fairly well. They're able to share the gospel. but they run out of medical supplies. And he has a lot back in Singapore of supplies, and he decides, okay, I'm going to go back to Singapore and bring the supplies back here. What he didn't know was that there had been a fire at the London Missionary Society there, and all of his stuff is gone. So when he arrives in Singapore, there's nothing. And so he decides he's going to go see another doctor, Dr. Parker, and get some supplies from him at Ningpo. So he goes to Ningpo, and while he's there, he helps Parker organize a new hospital, and he meets more missionaries at Ningpo. So there's a gal who is a single missionary that is there, and she's been in China for quite a while, and she's taken on a couple of gals whose parents had been killed. And there she takes them on almost as her own daughters. And so one evening they get in Parker and his family and Hudson get invited over to have an evening meal there. And he gets introduced to them, and he finds one of them quite charming. So Maria Dyer, he finds her quite charming, and he decides, I need to get to know her better. As he prepared to return to Swato, though, the door was closed. So his friend at Swato had gone and done some work somewhere else, and when he came back, they weren't allowed back into the city. And it was, Hudson found it to be really sad, because he felt like they were doing good work and had been received well there. But he decided that was the best thing to do was to go back to Ningpo then. So, and eventually Hudson and a fellow missionary, John Jones, started a church at Ningpo. And not only did Hudson want the Chinese to turn to Christ under his preaching, he wanted to train the Chinese to become evangelists to their own people. And he thought about this number-wise, how many missionaries it would take to reach the Chinese. It would just be impossible, the numbers of people in China. So he thought the best way to do is to train the Chinese to be evangelists as well. So that was kind of a new concept as far as the English missionaries in China. So eventually Hudson proposed marriage to Maria Dyer, which her guardian did not like at all. She thought Hudson was a loser, and dressing like the Chinese and all this. She threw a fit and said, "No, you're not." But he appealed to her relatives, and they gave consent for her to be married. So Hudson and Maria took over management of the hospital, because Dr. Parker's wife died of cholera, and Parker had four children, so he decided to return to England with his four children. So Hudson and his wife now ran that hospital for quite a while, and things went well. But then Hudson got sick with tuberculosis himself. And at first he just kept going and kept going without saying, I need to go somewhere and get well. But eventually there was no choice but to return to England and get well. He was only 28 years old at the time, though. So he'd worked in China 6 years. So he's back in England, and it takes him a while to get well, but he's not idle during the time that he's getting well. He brought back with him a fellow Chinese, or a Chinese person, to help him translate the New Testament. And he was thinking about, how can I be more effective, or how can the mission be more effective in China than we've been before? And one way he decided he needed to improve his medical training. So he spent time formally getting better medical training, and he translated with the help of this young man into the Chinese, new Chinese alphabet instead of just pictographs. And he prayed for and recruited more missionaries for China. And he decided, since the mission group had failed him and he quit them anyway, he decided to start his own new mission society, and he called it the China Inland Mission. And one thing that they did that was different than others is he took people from any denomination as long as they were true believers. So after several years in England, Hudson and his family and 16 new missionaries boarded a ship to go to China. The captain of the ship was a Christian, but most of the members of the crew weren't. And they were pretty rough, and they grumbled about these Bible-carrying, hymn-singing passengers. And one of the hymns that they sang first was, "Yes, We Part, But Not Forever." It's also called Parting. It's not in our hymnal. By the time they reached China, that many members of the crew had trusted Christ. And so so a lot of those members of the crew sang with the missionaries at him as they got off the ship. Now, before they arrived in China, though, they endured two typhoons and didn't look like they were going to even make it to China. And I don't know if I'd mentioned it before, but his first trip to China, they had only been out about 4 days and endured a terrible windstorm that they didn't think they were going to survive. And Hudson told the ship captain, "We're going to survive because God's called me to China, so we're going to make it." And when that ship, when it got around and into the Indian Ocean, they ended up with becalmed seas. And so they went from a terrible windstorm before to no wind at all, and the ship just drifting, and it was going to end up on a reef and crash. But they prayed, and winds came up, even though no one thought that they would. Okay, the China Inland Mission. They decided to headquarter in China rather than Britain. Of course, they had people in Britain to recruit missionaries and get ready too, but the headquarters was actually in China. And they emphasized training and equipping Chinese Christians to evangelize other Chinese. And they planned to go to all the provinces, not just the coastal cities. So far, the other English missions to China had just been to cities on the coast. And part of that is that's all that China really wanted to let happen. And the agreement with the British and other European countries that they would allow them into those coastal ports. But Hudson believed they needed to go to all the provinces. By 1866, they had 22 missionaries, and by 1905, when Hudson died, the organization had 825.
Wow.
And they also had 300 missionary stations spread out throughout the 22 provinces. And by 1905, China Inland Mission had 500 Chinese nationalists working for the missions and recorded 25,000 converts. Okay, Hudson's seven there. Hudson's new mission in Hangzhou and Yangzhou. So it took 4 weeks on the river to reach the city of Hangzhou. And most Chinese there had never seen a foreigner. They found a large building they could rent, and they repaired work on it and made it a headquarters and living space and a hospital. So it was a big, big place. And Hudson and his family served there 2 years before they moved further to Yangzhou. They moved to Yangzhou, and they found some buildings to buy there. But the city really didn't want them there. And they began to spread rumors that when they would take kids into their medical clinic, that actually killed the kids and ate them. So eventually an angry mob was outside of the clinic and their headquarters, and they wanted these people, the missionaries, gone, or they actually wanted to kill the missionaries. So they attacked the house. They boarded up the front door as best they could, but knew it wouldn't last forever. And so Hudson and another missionary slipped out the back, and they tried to get to the local magistrate to see if he would come and help. And they had to slip away in such a way nobody would see them being on their way as well. They got to the magistrate, and he seemed to think that maybe the rumors had been true about them being cannibals. So they had to talk to him quite a while before he decided to help them. The people back at the house, the Chinese had broken in. They escaped to a second floor and then jumped out a window 15 feet below. Two of the missionaries were hurt, including Hudson's wife, Maria. The magistrate then decided to help Hudson, and they calmed the people down. And a few weeks later, they reopened the mission and the medical clinic as a place of worship. So things went well after that there. Now, they were gone from the city for a while before they could come back that couple weeks later. So, in the final years, Hudson and Maria decided that they would send their four oldest kids back to Britain. They had one really young, like a two-year-old, but they would send the four oldest back to Britain to go to school. And on their way on the river to go to the coast so they could put on a ship, one of the boys died. And then on the way back, Maria gave birth, but Maria and the baby both passed away. So they lost the child earlier and buried in China. So Hudson took both the one that passed away earlier and the wife and child. They were all buried together. And Hudson ends up being buried there later on.
So Maria obviously was going back to England with the boy.
No, she was not going to. So on the trip on the river, one of the boys dies. Then on the way back to the mission, she passes. She has her baby passes away. So Hudson then, a few years later, he remarries. He's on a trip back to England, and so are some other missionaries from China, and there's a single gal there that he ends up deciding that God calls him to marry her. And so then he ends up back in England. So he makes several trips to England, actually, during his time. The mission endured the Boxer Rebellion. Now, the Boxer Rebellion is where the emperor dies and his wife takes over for a while, and she's really fanatical about China is for Chinese. And so the Boxer Rebellion doesn't have anything to do with whether you should box with gloves or fists or whatever. It has to do with the Boxers wanted to drive all foreigners out of China. And she encouraged it. So 130 missionaries were killed during that time and 50 of their children. So it was a rough time. Hudson spoke to crowds in Austria and New Zealand and the United States. And he ended up moving to Switzerland for health reasons. I was going to say something about the Boxer Rebellion, but I can't remember what it was going to be now.
What wasn't it kind of exacerbated by American journalists?
There were a lot of foreigners that were causing trouble. Yeah. So, but there were always people that were in China that China is for the Chinese. That's kind of a thing that they, and maybe it, not just China is like that. So, he ends up really in pretty serious health condition, so they move to the high country of Switzerland, and where he can get well. At the age of 72, he returned to China for his 11th trip. He was accompanied by his son, Howard, who was by then a medical doctor. And he visited several of the the China Inland Missions and spoke at their gatherings. And he dies while he was in China. He was buried alongside his wife, Maria, and their four children. So, his continuing legacy, the China Inland Mission. In 1900, the Chinese government called an end of missions and missionaries and extermination of Christianity. 188 missionaries were murdered. 79 of them were from China Inland Mission. In 1934, China Inland Mission had 1,368 missionaries. And in 1950, because of communism, all of the missions were kicked out of China. And so China Inland Mission changed their name to Overseas Missionary Fellowship so that they would really, they're still in East Asia, but wanted to their name to reflect more that they weren't just in China. And now it's called OMF International. Don't know if any of you know any missionaries that work for them or not.
What was the motivation in the 1900s?
It was similar to the Boxer Rebellion, that they just decided they should all be gone. Okay, some takeaways here. God answered the prayers of Hudson Taylor's parents and sister for him to be saved when he had decided when he was a young man that he wasn't interested in God and there was no way for him to ever be a Christian. And God had answered the prayers of Hudson Taylor's parents that he would be a missionary to China. And God supplied all of Hudson Taylor's needs. Sometimes Taylor's foes included some of the people who should have been his friends. So when he first got to be a missionary there, some of the other missionaries really were obstacles for good work. The CIM met the needs of people through medical help as they spread the gospel, and CIM trained Chinese to do the work of an evangelist. God worked greatly through the China Inland Mission, and life was often difficult for Hudson Taylor as he followed Christ. Got some quotes there by Taylor, and then I was going to read this. It's called Never Made a Sacrifice. James and Amelia Taylor loved their children like doting parents. They enjoyed them with little treats on occasion. This is James Hudson Taylor. But once in a while, when Amelia brought a dessert to the table for her family, James would say, "Who will see if they can do without today?" He explained to the children this way. By and by, you will have to say no to yourself when we are not there to help you, and you will find it very difficult, and you want the thing tremendously. So let's try to practice now, for the sooner you begin, the stronger will be the habit. The children are not punished if they chose not to give up the sweet, but if they are able to go an entire day without it, they were rewarded with some other treat, or most importantly, with the loving approval of their parents. Hudson Taylor took this lesson to heart. Oh, I guess that was his parents. Hudson Taylor took this lesson to heart and learned how to say no to himself when he went to live a life characterized by self-denial for the sake of the gospel. And yet when he looked back over his long life, he said, "I've never made a sacrifice." How could he honestly say such a thing? From his conversion to his teens, Hudson Taylor had a deep passion for God and a desire to serve him as a missionary in China. Although all through his young adulthood, his focus on his goal never failed. Most of China's inland cities had never seen a foreign missionary, and a million Chinese each month were dying without ever hearing the gospel. Taylor could not understand how any believer could be unmoved in the face of such a staggering need. He left his home in Barnsley in 1850 to study medicine in London, planning to go to China for his first opportunity as a medical missionary. Taylor was touched by the plight of the poor and the slums of London. He chose to live among them, and in order to devote himself as much of his small income as possible, medicines and tract to alleviate both physical and spiritual suffering of the community. The damp and smelly neighborhood, aptly named Drainside, in which he rented a room, was full 4 miles from the hospital, which meant Taylor had at least a half hour's brisk walk each day in every kind of weather. He was willing to make that sacrifice to serve the poor. During his studies at the hospital, Taylor acquired was required to dissect a cadaver. While working on a particular dangerous specimen, a small wound in Taylor's finger allowed contaminants into the cadaver to enter his own bloodstream. He became ill almost immediately, and as soon as the teacher had learned on duty what had happened and diagnosed it, he urged Taylor to hurry home to get his affairs in order. "You're a dead man," he said, expecting Taylor to die within hours. Although Taylor did get sick, very sick, he recovered fully. The physician who cared for him credited Taylor's careful lifestyle and his long walks to and from the hospital, giving him the stamina to survive. Suddenly, his choice to live in Drainside didn't seem like a sacrifice. During the same time period, Taylor's life, a woman he loved refused to marry him unless he gave up his dream of serving China. Taylor ended this relationship with tears. He trusted God, like his parents at the dinner table, would provide something better for him later if he denied himself for the sake of the gospel. And his faith proved true. God provided a wife in China, one who shared his passion for missionary work. Maria grew up in China, the daughter of English missionaries in Shanghai. She was fluent in Mandarin, as she was in English, and became great help and comfort in Taylor's work. "It never cooled my love for her," he said 40 years later, "and has not cooled now." The relationship he gave up in London no longer seemed like a sacrifice. In China, Taylor found that to gain an audience with people, he needed to give up his European dress and customs. He adopted a pigtail and chopsticks and traveled from town to town, living on boats and small shacks or in attic garrets, usually battling insects and vermin. Once on a journey inland, he was robbed of his traveling bed, spare clothes, surgical instruments, and a Bible given to him by his mother. Taylor decided not to prosecute the thief because of the harsh Chinese penal system, but he wrote the culprit a letter instead, urging him to repent. He described his plea to the errant servant in a letter sent home. The letter somehow fell into the hands of George Mueller of Bristol. He was so impressed by the spirit of the writer that he became a supporter of the mission. Taylor's sacrifice of the right to prosecute the man who stole his bed resulted in a supporter who would provide him over $10,000 a year for the mission and would be a friend and advisor in times of trial. Looking back, giving up the right to justice did not seem like a sacrifice. Taylor endured the hardships, including arrests, insults, slander, and poverty, but he lived his life believing that Christ said in Mark 10:29-30, that if we give up everything for the sake of the gospel, we will receive blessings 100 times better in his life and eternal life in the world to come. With that perspective, he could truly have said, "I never made a sacrifice." All right, so maybe we'd be challenged by his life. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for the lessons of the life of Hudson Taylor, and that we would be inspired and challenged to be as much like that as we can. We pray this, that this hour to come, that we would be focused on you, and it would be a great time of worship. In Jesus' name.